Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. The topic this week is Lord of the Rings, Baldur's Gate, and author David Eddings. My guest this week dreams of great big musical adventure. Liam Essler is the co-founder of Summerfall Studios, a game company that's currently in development on a game called Chorus, which promises to be an adventure story that's also an interactive musical. Currently crowdfunding for the game, Liam leaned heavily on prior experiences to develop the concept. He went to school for theater, but in his free time, he taught himself to modify video games to include more queer content. Now, he's finally bringing those two sides of his past together. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a big thanks to everyone who makes the Sewers of Paris possible with a pledge of support on Patreon. Head over to sewersofparis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon to check out the rewards for backers. And just a reminder that the Sewers of Paris is on Twitter and Facebook. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode. And I hope you'll join me for our next fun, friendly live stream on November 16th. It's a laid-back, brunchtime chat about the books and movies and music and shows that are bringing you joy right now. There's a link at the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Now, here's Liam. Well, this week I'm speaking with Liam Essler, Managing Director of Summerfall Studios. Thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
Depends on the medium. I think for books, early on, the first actual book that I read was Tolkien. It was The Lord of the Rings.
And wait, you said the first actual book?
That was the first actual book that I ever read, which I think sets a great example of just how precocious I was as a child.
How old were you when this happened?
I was probably like 8.
Okay.
Sawed through. I mean, I'd read like little tiny things before, but it was the first novel that I read, and maybe it was a little overambitious, but I think that that's been something echoed throughout my life and entire career. So, I guess, yeah, cool. And I think that The Lord of the Rings was definitely a great introduction to fantasy in general. And from there, I think probably what changed my life slash viewpoint more than Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings was a great intro point, but it was David Eddings' books that really hooked me onto fantasy as a genre. And sort of set a lot of my... Well, didn't set my preferences, but showed a lot of the different preferences that I had for witty dialogue and interesting characters and lots of interpersonal politics between characters and all that kind of stuff. That's what I'm into now, and I can trace that back pretty much precisely to David Eddings, because Lord knows that was not Tolkien.
I'm not familiar with David Eddings, so
sure.
What is the comparison?
Eddings is basically, I kind of like to think of it as like trash fantasy, in the sense that it is popcorn. Like, his books are very, very fluffy and light and easy. They're an easy read. They're very witty. They're filled with funny characters and dialogue. And they're just kind of breezy. Whereas Tolkien is very dense, difficult to get through, filled with way too much song and poetry as for a written medium. They're very, very different authors. And I have later learned that David Eddings was a pretty terrible person. Which sucks, because I loved his work so much. But as like having reread them, like all of his books as an adult, there are definite threads of like really clear like misogyny and you know, even a little bit of homophobia in some of them, little bit of transphobia. Like, they were very much of their time. But Eddings took the tropes of Campbell's...
The Hero with a Thousand Faces.
The monomyth, that's what... Eddings took the monomyth and kind of translated that to what contemporary fantasy now does with it. And he kind of... He was the one who was like, oh, cool, we're just going to set this into a formula for contemporary books. And I really enjoyed that. And all of his books are the same. Like, every series of his follows exactly the same formula.
Okay.
And that's... So you kind of know what you're in for. and it's mostly just like what happens and how it goes about and who the characters are that's different. And even the characters, sometimes you can still tell that there's a lot of similarities there. So if that was the book that changed my life, The West Wing is probably the TV series that I appreciate the most.
Those are very different.
Extremely different. But they're very similar in one specific way, which is they're both character dramas. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that I noticed throughout all of my preferences is a character drama always takes the cake. It's always the most important thing to me. Mm. I was not interested in politics at all before The West Wing. And it completely changed how I engaged with politics and what I thought about politics, what I cared about, and also, you know, followed the trend of me really liking witty dialogue and being very dialogue focused. Whatever you may think of Sorkin himself, no one can argue that his dialogue is witty and funny and unique. Whether you think it's good or not is another thing. I've had a lot of people who really don't like Sorkin-esque dialogue, or which, you know, has something in common with maybe Buffy speak from Whedon.
Sure, some qualities. I would compare it more to Gilmore Girls.
Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a cadence, there's a rhythm, there's a very specific way that it's played. Yeah. Yeah, Buffy was also like a pretty big influence on me as a kid, but I think I sort of came into The West Wing in my late teens, so I was able to appreciate it in a way that I hadn't appreciated other shows before. I think I probably, and my partner introduced it to me, and we probably watched it through together like 5 or 6 times all the way through. Wow. Yeah,
also,
like
who? Who is this like precocious kid who's reading Lord of the Rings at 8 and like as a teenager being like, I'm very into American political drama?
Yeah, that's me. Hi. Yeah, like it. I was a very interesting kid. I was super nerdy. When I was a kid, I didn't have a lot of friends. I had a very small circle of friends. I was picked upon a lot. I was very lucky that I didn't really have a lot of bullying or anything like that. I was in a very, very liberal school. Even though I grew up in, you know, rural Adelaide, which is in South Australia. So I lived about an hour out of the city in the country. I was very lucky that, you know, my community and my parents were very progressive generally. So I didn't have a lot of the traditional growing up queer shit, but what I did have was being a very precocious kid who cared a lot about school. I went to a Waldorf school, so a Steiner school, which is a very different education system as well. By the end of school, I think that the whole class had kind of bonded, and we had a very small number of people in our high school class all the way through. It fluctuated between maybe like 10 to 16. And everyone was extremely different. And so in order to survive, we all had to learn how to cope with people who were very different than ourselves in many ways. And I think that taught me a lot of skills that later became very useful when I would run teams or, as it turns out, a company. But yeah, like I was definitely a weird kid, and even going into uni, I was the one who would freak out if I didn't get like an A plus. I had extremely high standards for myself, and continue to. When was it? I was talking to my partner the other day about this fig is so hard. Why is everything I ever do so difficult? Like, can't I just have something easy for once? And he laughed at me. And I was like, that's not fair. Why are you laughing at me? And he said, Liam, you've never picked anything easy. You continuously pick the most difficult path you can. And usually you succeed. And I was like, oh, yeah, right, okay. That ambition is reflected from being a kid, yeah.
You know, and if I think of Lord of the Rings or I think of West Wing, I mean, those are also stories about characters who often pick the hardest paths possible, or at least are confronted by the hardest paths possible.
Yeah.
What was your... You said you were very interested in... Or maybe not interested, but, like, school was very important to you.
Mm.
Was it purely just, like, the kind of dopamine hit of being able to get good grades or, you know, meeting the approval of getting good grades? Or, like, what was it in there? And surely it wasn't just, like, school is all I care about, because you were also into, like, Lord of the Rings and fantasy and stuff like
totally.
That.
I think that a lot of it comes down to what I have later through, you know, therapy and extreme self-reflection have come to realize is a deep and deep-seated need to be liked and for approval. And I think to me, I always wanted the approval of authority figures, so it came down to essentially if I did well in class, my teachers would approve of me or like of me, and that was good. Because that was the only... Because I didn't have a lot of friends, I didn't have that, like, friend attention. That was the positive attention that I could get. I was the model student as a result. Like, I befriended every teacher. Even in university, I became friends with all the lecturers and the tutors and everyone. I was that kid. My degree was filled with topic exceptions, which basically meant that through my entire degree, I did topics that I probably shouldn't have been able to in the degree that I was doing, because I was able to go to the lecturers and be like, hey, I really want to do this topic. Can I get like an exception in my degree to do that instead of this other topic I don't want to do? So my degree was like a Franken degree, and when it came to graduating, they had to do a bunch of paperwork to actually allow me to graduate, which was pretty funny.
Well, what were the topics that were interesting to you? Like, where did you want to get that approval?
So I was doing theatre. So in the Waldorf system of education, your final year in year 12, you do a special project, and that special project accounts for a significant part of your final grade. And you can do it on pretty much anything you want.
Okay.
So I did it on acting, script writing, and directing for theatre, because I'd always been interested in theatre and stuff like that, and had a great time. I loved doing that project. I wrote some obscene amount of script. I think I ended up writing like 90,000 words over the year. And directed 3 plays and was in an additional 2 plays as an actor. I was taking dance classes and acting classes and a lot of other stuff, and screenwriting classes and scripting classes. And so when I graduated, initially I wanted to have a gap year and go traveling, which is like a kind of a tradition in Australia after you finish school. Mm-hmm. And then I think a month passed after school finished, and I was like, oh, nope, that's too scary. I'm going straight to uni. And so I ended up going into a Bachelor of Arts because I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I thought I'll just do a bunch of different topics, and then gravitated really quickly towards the theatre and media studies topics. Theatre because, well, it was theatre. And I loved doing that. So I ended up majoring in theatre, but the degree that I ended up transferring into was a Bachelor of Media. And had a lot to do with media studies and media theory, which has a lot of cross-contamination with theater theory as well. And those two topics have helped me more than any games education that I ever could have gotten in working in video games, which is pretty funny in retrospect.
What kind of, in your studies, what shows were you in, and what did you write about?
Just a lot of different stuff. Like, in school, I was in a bunch of just random musicals by local playwrights. Shakespeare was always fun. It was a lot of the normal high school stuff. And then occasionally, I'd do something really off the wall. We did like a production of The Breakfast Club, which we rewrote. And we did a bunch of surrealist plays. By an author whose name I've completely forgotten, but he's just he was a small time playwright, and my acting teacher had found his work online, And we ended up doing this three-part series of his work. And it was so weird and so cool, and we had such a good time doing it. I did, yeah, musical theater as well, which was always fun, and has now weirdly intersected with my professional career in a way that I never expected. So...
Did you have any, like, tell me about your favorite roles that you were in.
My favorite roles. So there was this really stupid musical that at the time I hated, and it was by a local playwright, and it was objectively bad. It was an objectively bad script. No one will have heard of it because it was just a random play. I've never been able to find mention of it online. The lead character was this like dopey, stupid, straight guy who somehow just like stumbled through life in the way I'd like to think a very generic cis heterosexual man would. He was such a fun character to play because he was just so over the top. And in real life, I tend to be very... careful in how I present myself. I'm not usually that over the top. I am fairly conservative with my self-expression. And so getting to play a character that was so bizarre and so out there and just completely the opposite of how I presented myself was really fun.
Yeah, you said you grew up in a fairly rural setting, but also that there wasn't too much homophobia that you had to deal with, right?
Yeah, not really. Like it was definitely there in some cases. Like, I can definitely remember sometimes just, like, walking down the street and having teenage guys yell, like, faggot out the window and stuff like that. But, there were isolated incidents rather than recurrent themes.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting, and you know that you were still feeling the need to be more conservative or withdrawn or not just not present yourself fully. Because often when I talk to queer people about their experience, it's because they felt like they were in danger or that it just wasn't a safe place to express themselves.
I think I still felt that, and I remember a conversation with my dad that was very well meaning. But extremely misguided. And it was soon after I'd come out to him for like the second time, because I'd forgotten that I'd done it as a 12-year-old.
Oh.
Which I did, as it turns out. Dad was like, yeah, you told me when you were 12. And I was like, what? What?
Do you remember that now?
No, I literally don't remember it at all. So this was like, I was like 14, 15, and he said, okay, like, I'm really proud of you for telling me again, but, you know, like, we're in a small town and you need to be very careful about how flamboyant you are, because that can be dangerous. And when I grew up, I had a lot of gay friends who were targeted for how they behaved. So just like, be careful. And I think that conversation had an indelible effect on me and the way that I presented myself after that. And, you know, continues to have behavioral ramifications now, like 12, 14 years later. It was a very well-meaning conversation. Like, he was trying to do the right thing, or what he thought was the right thing, and protect me. But in doing so, accidentally... caused me to completely reevaluate my every behavior and suddenly become incredibly self-conscious.
Right.
And I was already a social chameleon at that point, by necessity. I like to joke that between being a child with no friends and a teen with a lot of friends, I had to develop a sense of humor, and I had to become personable and charming as a defense mechanism. And pairing that with the advice to be less flamboyant, I think basically caused me to become self-conscious all the time. And I was also doing acting at the same time. So I was studying and learning how to change how I behaved and how to change my posture and how to represent myself physically and behaviorally for the stage. And so I think that all of these things together completely... it was just like a weird confluence. And I'm still like, even mm-hmm. today, I still pay a lot of attention to how I come across. It's very considered. And a lot of people tell me that sometimes I can feel disingenuous or cold because I do come across as very considered. Like I strategize everything. And I think that it comes back to that, right?
You didn't find that studying acting and dramatization and characters, like, did not require that you, loosen up a little bit, or at least to portray a character? It seems like you would have to understand the masks that you wear in real life and recognize when you're doing it.
Oh, totally. And it did. But I think that instead of making me more... able to express myself physically or fashion wise or behaviorally, it instead allowed me to curate my persona in a way that I hadn't been able to before because I wasn't as conscious about it.
What are the personas that you put across?
I think that I tend to be like, I am always very considered, very charming and funny, but it's not like, it's always genuine, right? Like, that's the thing. Like, it's not disingenuous. I don't not mean it when I'm nice to people because I am nice, but there are definitely times where I will be very considered because I am uncomfortable, or I will present myself in a way that best suits the situation, which I think everybody does to a certain extent. I'm just very conscious about the way in which I do that. Which is always really interesting. Just behaviorally.
How did that intersect with your online life? Because I know that you had a lot of... You're pretty active in, like, engaging with people socially online, which introduces this whole other medium in which you can create a persona.
Right. I think that it just meant that I was... My friends used to joke I had, like, a brand.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so conscious about how I came across online. I was very particular about... Like, I curated my social media feed how a company would curate their social media mm-hmm. feed. Like, it was very intentional, and I would, pick certain things to retweet because I knew that they were like relevant to my interests and would present me in a certain light and stuff like that. Like, it was very considered, and I don't do that anymore. Apart from, not just shit posting and posting ridiculous stuff. And now that I run a company, I also have to consider the ramifications of what I say on, the entity that I've created and all of my coworkers and my co-founder. So that changes things too, but it was definitely a highly curated experience. Not that it was, again, like, not that it was disingenuous. It was just that I would selectively show parts of myself and was very conscious of that process.
What sort of, you had like social media and stuff like that. Can you tell me a little about the ways that you found your nerdy interests manifesting themselves online?
Basically, I can trace my interest in quote-unquote nerdy things, apart from reading, back to a D&D game I played when I was pretty young, like 12 or 13. And it was a short campaign. It was like maybe 8, 12 sessions with an older guy who was not a parental figure, but like an older brother figure for one of my other friends. Mm-hmm. And so he DM'd this group, and then he ended up moving away to England. And before he left, he gave each of us like a present. And he gave me a game called Baldur's Gate 2. He was like, I think you'll really like this. And so I got that game And a couple of years earlier, I've been playing a game called Creatures, which is like an artificial life series. And I I liked the game, but what I found I enjoyed most was actually like making modifications to the game and modding it. And so I kind of developed a bit of an interest in that. And then I got this game, Baldur's Gate 2, which I adored and played to death. And then I was like, can I mod Baldur's Gate 2? And it turns out you could. And thus began like a decade long hobby where I would make modifications for games, but particularly the Infinity Engine series. And that was definitely a particularly geeky and nerdy part of my life for a very long time that now has resulted in me, you know, running a games company and being in the games industry.
It seems at the same time so completely separate from drama and stage and being live in front of people, but also, like, you know, fundamentally you're creating a situation and you're doing drama just in like an incredibly different way of engaging with an audience.
I think that I have a couple of like pet theories that I love in the video game development sphere. One of them is that a game is more than just the game. It's also the entire experience you have around the game. So therefore, marketing is a crucial part of your playing experience. But the one that I believe most of all is that theater is much closer to games than film is to games. If you imagine the player as both actor and audience, and you give them a script, that is a much closer parallel than a viewer at a cinema. So you are given a framework in which to act, and you are allowed to self-express within that however you will. And to me, that's a much closer explanation of how someone behaves in a video game than someone sitting passively at a cinema. And so I try to take that into every project that I work on. And in Chorus, like, we spend a lot of time thinking about how we would visually present the game. And when I had a lot of conversations with our art director, Benjamin E., we kept coming back to that idea of stagecraft rather than cinema set pieces. We looked more to K-pop music videos than, you know, film. And so it's all these big theatrical things that we felt were much more representative of the game and genre we were trying to create. I've always found that theater and games is just, there's something about them that links them really closely. And the longer that I've spent in games and the more narrative designers in particular that I've spoken to, the more I've realized that the best narrative designers are the ones who have a theatrical background of some kind. And it turns out a lot of them do, like an unusually high amount of games writers and narrative designers come from theater backgrounds rather than filmic backgrounds. Which is totally anecdotal, but I think there's, like, within those conversations, there's definitely something interesting going on, and I would love for somebody to study that in more detail at some point, but it's definitely something that I've noticed, and I've definitely noticed that my knowledge of theater has helped me out a lot more than my knowledge of film generally.
What kind of, in those modding communities that you were in, and as you're, like, creating content for Baldur's Gate, what kind of LGBTQ community did you find through that that probably would not have been available to you where you were growing up?
Totally. I think that that was one of the primary reasons that I ended up sticking around modding communities, was because I, like, where I grew up, I didn't know any other queer people at all. The only other queer person I knew was my aunt, and she lived a couple of hours away. And so being able to be online kind of when the internet was just really opening up and becoming a thing in the late 90s, early 2000s, was really special. And, you know, the first trans people I met were over the internet, and I got to, you know, be friends with them through their transitions. And learn perspectives that I just wasn't exposed to at all. I got to meet other queer people and become friends with other queer people. And I think that that had an indelible effect on me and made me much more secure in my own identity than I otherwise would have. Because even though I didn't experience a lot of day-to-day homophobia, the lack of queer, you know, authority figures and leadership figures and people to look up to definitely did have an effect. I think that I didn't really have anyone in my life to look up to like that. Mm. And I was very lucky to find people like that on the web in these communities and become friends with them.
What sort of content were you making?
Oh gosh, all kinds of things. Like for the Creatures series, I would make like new worlds for the game. Just every part of development I touched, whether it was art, you know, production, project management, concept art, 3D, sound design, a bit of music, like every part of the game development pipeline. And then in terms of the content that I was creating, it was everything. Like, I just tried doing everything. I just really enjoyed doing it. And I liked the challenge of it. In Baldur's Gate 2, by the time that I was modding Baldur's Gate 2, I was much more focused on characters. Mm-hmm. And so the majority of what I was making was like new characters for the game, and new NPCs, new quests and stuff like that. But mostly it was new joinable companions. And I had a group of friends in the BG2 community who also created a lot of LGBTQ content. Mm-hmm. And so we often, you know, we would work together on projects and, you know, help gay up Baldur's Gate in various ways. And I, you know, I collaborated with a lot of different people. And I think that working on these modding projects is definitely how I learned games production. But I wasn't doing it in uni. I was doing it at like 13 years old when I was running a team of 30 people asynchronously online. And I didn't really know what I was doing at the time. I was just doing it for fun. But I look back and I'm like, holy fuck, how the fuck did I do that?
Yeah, that level of productivity.
It was obscene. I worked out at one point that I shipped like 60 different medium to large scale projects over like a 10-year period.
Wow, that is pretty extensive.
Kind of ridiculous. And that's not to say that I did all of that work myself, but those are all projects that I had like a primary stake in, and I was one of the primary creators.
When you look back at that stuff, was there content that you were making that was sort of autobiographical, or were you putting yourself into the characters that you were making?
I think in the writing that I was doing, absolutely. I think that you can't help that as a writer. You're always going to represent some part of you, because as we're writing, all of our writing is filtered through the lens of our own experience. So when we create characters and give them certain traits, we understand how those traits express themselves through our own experience, what we've seen, the way that we behave, the way that we think. And so I think that regardless of whether it's intended or not, there's always a part of us in everything we write, just because it comes from you, right? So there was definitely, like, there's a character that I wrote named Arath, who was a joinable druid, like a bisexual joinable druid who I wrote a romance for in Baldur's Gate 2. And he definitely has, like, as I look back, I'm like, ooh, that hits, like, parts of that hit a little close to home. Like, but I found that, using humor to deflect from feeling, and using charm as a way to avoid actual interaction, stuff like that, where it's getting to play on the surface level because you're uncomfortable of going deeper, stuff like that. And that reading back is like really, really interesting to be like, oh cool, like that was even happening back then.
Well, that does feel very, you know, that kind of Sorkin-esque dialogue of using wit to give yourself a sort of ironic detachment.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And I think that, like, as an adult now, and I, you know, now that I have a lot more experience in how people relate and react to one another, so much of emotion is subtextual. Mm. We rarely say to our friends, I love you, but we will totally invite them out to dinner, or we will check in, we will send them a random Facebook message with a meme. That one in particular has become really interesting to me of late. Like, there are friends that we all have who we send links mm-hmm. to and memes and stuff like that. And that's a way of expressing affection that's completely non-textual. It's a way of saying, hey, I care about you and I'm thinking about you. This reminded me of you. Or in Australia, it's often, shit-talking each other in various ways as a way of expressing mm-hmm. affection. And as I look back to my early writing, I can even see that, like, I understood that then, even if it was on an unconscious level, because of the way that I related to people, and that's really interesting. There are definitely things that I didn't get as a child, but that was one of the ones that I look back and I'm like, oh, cool. Like, that's really, that's kind of cute. That's fun.
You've shipped and worked on a ton of stuff since then. Have you found that in the process of making stuff and being a creator that has made it, I don't know, given you some more comfortability in expressing yourself, like, in real life, away from your work?
I think so, for sure. I also think that because I'm a very validation-driven person, as I've been able to create more stuff and reveal more parts of myself, and people have been like, oh, me too. Mm. Like, extremely same, or, you know, like, I really relate to that. That's helped me to realize that the parts that I don't like about myself are, you know, normal and common, and everyone struggles with these kinds of issues. And I think that is, through my projects and through others' interactions with my projects, allowed me to feel more comfortable with myself, even retrospectively. And so it's definitely given me more security, I guess, in how I behave. Mm-hmm. And now I do feel more comfortable being stupid. Mm-hmm. One thing that I do find really interesting is, like, I don't dance. And it's not because I can't dance. It's because I'm so uncomfortable at the idea of not doing it perfectly that I just don't do it. Like, I'm not a bad dancer. I'm somewhere between mediocre and okay. Mm-hmm. But I just won't do it because I know that it's not going to present me in the very best light.
Sure.
And I just find that hilarious. Like, from a self-reflection standpoint, like, what a ridiculous thing that I just can't feel comfortable letting loose on a dance floor because I'm worried what other people will think about me in a space where that doesn't matter at all, and that's not
sure.
the point.
No, I, like, as you were saying before, extremely same, where, like, I have the same feeling of, like, well, they're not going to be, like, amazed and blown away by my dance skill, and why would they? I have no reason to be a good dancer, and yet still, I feel like I put this expectation on myself that I would be for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, it's very funny.
and also say, like, when you said that, like, the first novel that you read was Lord of the Rings, I did have that, like, little moment of that you were just talking about of, like, recognition, because one of the first novels that I remember reading was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe at around the same age, and also having a long period in my life where I was like, okay, well, I guess this is the kind of kid I am. I like this stuff that nobody else in the world has ever liked before, and I can't relate to anybody because this makes me weird. And then years later being like, oh no, actually, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
My people are out there.
Like, yeah, same. Yeah, yeah. It's really interesting.
Have you had, like, some of those moments when you're like, oh, I found my people through this thing that I thought was, like, you know, the thing that set me apart and made me unrelatable?
I think that primarily, how would I answer that question? I think a lot of it comes down to privilege, actually, weirdly. So I do a lot of travel. Like, being in games, being in games and in Australia, one of the only ways that I feel like I can be successful is if I can travel to events like the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco every year. And that's a pretty uncommon experience. Not everyone has gone to San Francisco for a conference 7 years running. And so I think that a lot of the people that I meet that I'm closest to are people who do the same thing. they're people who have met through the games industry online or at events, who like were in a similar position of privilege to be able to do that and also understand how shit that is. It's a really weird one. So it, like, there's this part that's definitely, they're often queer or queer adjacent people, people who are minorities in various ways. They're people who travel a lot and really hate it, but have to do it for their jobs. And they're people who have experience with community leadership in some way. And I think that the intersection of those things is very specific. And when you meet people who have the same kind of intersections that you do, it can be easy to just, you know, when you meet someone and it's like, oh, you've just known each other forever. Mm-hmm. I think that for me, it's those kinds of people where we have like this very bizarrely specific intersection. A lot of my best friends are people that I only see like once or twice a year, if that. But the people who I've found through video games, who share a lot of the same experiences that I've had.
When you have formed those groups, it seems like it's something that has really directed, at least professionally, the work that you do, going to conferences and doing the work and being committed to your projects. Particularly, I'm thinking of like the work that you're doing right now at this second with Chorus.
Yeah.
How did the project like come about? And we should probably like explain what Chorus is.
Sure. So, Chorus is an adventure musical. So it's one part dialogue and narrative driven adventure game, one part interactive musical, and one part kind of urban fantasy narrative / romance game. So it's like bits of Buffy, bits of Dream Daddy, bits of Life is Strange, and bits of Dragon Age all kind of rolled into one. And it came about because, so I've been running the Australian Game Developers Conference, Game Connect Asia Pacific, for a couple of years. I was doing a lot of freelance game stuff on the side, but I was getting pretty tired of running events. I'd kind of hit a plateau where I knew that I was good at what I did, and it was hard but not challenging in the way that I like. And I'm a very complacent kind of person, naturally, and so I have to push myself out of my comfort zone pretty radically sometimes. So I started to feel comfortable in that role, and I was like, oh, time to move on. Like, I've clearly learned what I had to learn here. Time to do something new. And so I was starting to think about what I want to do, and one day I just woke up and I was like, oh, I'm going to start a game studio. Like, that easy.
Sure.
As you know, as you do. Like, you just start a game studio, right? And I immediately started to ask other people for advice. One of the things that I pride myself on is that I absolutely do not know much, but I know a lot of people who do know a lot, and I regularly ask for help and advice. And so at all stages during, you know, making Summer Fool Studios and Chorus, I've been lucky enough to have this giant group of people to ask questions of and ask questions I have. So I quickly realized that I didn't want to do it by myself. I wanted to have a co-founder, somebody who I shared, who shared a lot of the same passions as me and had the same values, I guess, to use a more corporate term, as I did. Like, cared about the same things as I did. And I quickly realized that although I was very capable of the creative aspects, the most important part of any game studio is actually the business. Because if the business doesn't exist and isn't strong, then the studio can't sustain itself. So I'd learned some business stuff while working at the Game Developers Association of Australia, and I'd done lots of production consulting, which verged on business dev consulting. And so I was like, okay, well, I could probably take on that role, but then I would need a creative co-founder. And I when I was thinking of different people I'd want to work with, it wasn't a very long list. And right at the top of that list was a guy that I'd met a couple of years earlier at GamerX3 in San Jose, which is also, I think, where I met you the first time.
I think that's correct, yeah.
Yeah. So I also met David Gator there. Mm. And we got along really, really well. And kind of stayed friends for years after that. He came back to Australia when Joshua Meadows and I were running GamerX Australia here. And so he was kind of at the top of that list. I was like, you know, in terms of someone I like to found a studio with, I want somebody who has a lot more experience than I do creatively, who I get along well with, and who cares about the same things that I do. There was one year where we were at GDC together, and this is before I was really even thinking about a co-founder. And Dave and I were like getting drunk in a bar somewhere during GDC. And we were just talking. I was like, here's a dream studio I would love to make one day. Mm. And he was like, hey, did I talk to you about what I wanted to do? And I was like, no. He's like, 'cause it sounds like you're stealing the idea that I had. I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. So we talked a little bit then and, you know, realized that, you know, we were very much on the same page about our values and what we cared about. And then, like, jumping forward again, when I was thinking through, like, this list of people, he was very high on that list because we'd had this conversation. It all just kind of then fell into place. This was one of those weirdly serendipitous projects where everything just kind of worked. Mm. Or at least it seemed that way. It absolutely was not. You know, the way that Summerfall and Chorus has come together was because of, you know, a decade of extremely hard work of networking mm-hmm. and meeting people and building relationships and friendships and learning and stuff like that. But if I think about it in isolation, it was basically like, oh, me and Dave had a conversation, then we started a studio together, and then within that first conversation, we kind of decided we wanted to make a musical. And then, you know, like, we started to muck around with ideas, and then by the time we formally got around to it, which was much, much later that year, you know, and then they got to GDC, and we had basically, like, a proof of concept video that we were shipping around, and a lot of people really liked the idea. And through a friend, Austin Wintery, heard about it. And so on the last day of GDC, I got a message from him being like, hey, I'm only here for a couple more hours before I fly out, but I've heard about your project through a friend and I really want to meet you because I want to do something very similar. And so I met him in Yerba Buena Park above the Moscone Center. And again, it was one of those conversations where I was like, here's what I want to do. And he's like, yeah. And blah, 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 blah. And I was like, yeah. Mm-hmm. We were basically, you know, he immediately understood what we were trying to do. And it turned out he'd been wanting to do a musical project for years. And then when we were building our demos, his friend Troy Baker came in to sing a little bit, and they'd talked about doing a musical together at some point. And then eventually Troy ended up coming on board as our voice director because he was so passionate about the project and what we were doing. And he just sort of... We all just had this very similar understanding of what we were trying to do. And it's pretty rare you work on a project where you get that. Like, it was the same, like, our art director, Ben, which is Dave and I were looking through a bunch of different concept artists in Australia, and I knew Ben peripherally. And we saw his art, and we were like, oh, yeah, that's the art for the mm-hmm. project. Like, and then we talked to him about it. He's like, oh, yeah. And he quit his job and came and started working with us. Like, it was over the process of, like, 3 months or something ridiculous. Like, it was, like, boom. And then... Yeah, the whole project has been, like, weirdly serendipitous.
It really does sound like one of those things where when you bring up this idea, it feels like, well, there's not a lot of stuff out there that's like this, so maybe this is just, like, too wacky to exist. But then, like, so many of the conversations that it sounds like you've had about it have been the person being like, yes, I've been waiting for this my whole life.
Yep, that's it in a nutshell.
And, you know, because it's such a unique concept, or at least the sort of thing that has not been the sort of product that is not, like, out in the market, really, I imagine it, like, everybody involved must have had sort of a feeling of, simultaneously wanting to do this thing, but also feeling like, oh, but maybe this isn't, you know, this isn't something people want, or maybe this doesn't, maybe it's just me who wants this.
We've definitely gone up and down about it. Mm-hmm. I think that the reason that we wanted to do it initially strategically for the studio was because it would create buzz. Like, it was marketable in the way that something is remarkable. Like, you can remark upon it. There's something there mm-hmm. that's unique to talk about. And when Dave and I were initially talking about a project, we knew we wanted to do something that was dialogue-driven. That was our strong suit. But we needed something that was going to make it sexy, essentially. Like, give it an X factor, which is something that a lot of narrative projects don't tend to have. Mm. And it makes it hard to talk about them. And when word of mouth is still, like, the best and biggest way we sell games, being able to talk about something is crucially important. And as soon as Dave was like, well, what about a musical? I was like, sold. Like, that was it. And then, yeah, as we talked to people and kind of explained how it worked and showed how it worked, everyone was like, oh, shit, yeah. But I think that there's been a lot of concern, like, particularly from publishers. Like, when we talk to publishers, they're like, look, we think this is super marketable. We think that this is really interesting and extremely, like, very unique. But there's no other product in the market we can draw a line to mm-hmm. that succeeded in the way that we would need it to. Nothing like this really exists in the commercial space in a big way. Like, there's stuff like Dominic Pamplemousse and Dominic Pamplemousse 2, which are amazing. And there are some other games that have musical elements, but nothing quite like this. Mm-hmm. And so it's definitely been a challenge to convince people that there is an audience. And when we were like, oh God, is there an audience mm-hmm. at certain points, that made it hard too. And that's part of the reason we wanted to do a crowdfunding campaign, was basically to be like, can we prove this? Mm. Like, this is one surefire way to do it. You know, like, through Fig, we have absolutely proved that there is an audience there for it. And that's been really awesome. Like, all of our back-end metrics are great. Like, our conversion rates are really, really good, and all of our marketing numbers are really good. And that's a really nice a vindication, I suppose, mm-hmm. of our initial theories. We were like, no, we think this very specific market exists, and nobody is really talking to them at the moment. Well, and so to prove that out has been great.
And it seems like it would have taken given those challenges that you're talking about, some amount of bravery and vulnerability to just, like, even say out loud that this is something that you wanted to do, to, you know, yeah. talk to these people in your life and people that you know professionally, and open up about, like, having this sort of unique idea. It takes some courage to be that open about your strange interests.
I hadn't really thought about it like that. I've never really considered it like that, I suppose. It was something that Dave and I spent a lot of time thinking about, and thinking about very strategically. So there were very specific reasons that we were talking about it, and we were talking about it to very specific people. I think this is, like, the first time that I, you know, obviously we've been public about it. That was nerve-wracking. Like, when you're in a one-on-one conversation, if you make a misstep in your communication of expectations, it's easy to reassert different expectations. When you're talking to a mass audience, it's incredibly difficult to reset expectations in any significant way. Mm-hmm. So you only get to make one impression. I think that idea in real life, or in meat space, so to speak, that you only get one chance to make a good impression isn't really correct. Like, you can always have a human conversation and, you know, prove someone wrong or change expectations. Online, it's a lot harder because it's a lot less human. And so I was extremely nervous about the way in which I was communicating about Chorus. Like, is this, even just the words adventure musical,
mm-hmm.
took a long time to reach. Like, we played around with so many different ways of talking about it. And that was the one that we ended up coming back to repeatedly, because it was pretty much the only one that was like, this is not a large scale AAA RPG, mm-hmm. which is what people expect from Dave. And this is not a music game. This is not a rhythm game. It's a musical.
Right.
If you say it's a musical game, people assume that it's a game with music in it, or where music features prominently, or it's a rhythm game. If you say it's an adventure musical, because it's suffixed with the word musical, people actually assume correctly that, you know, it's a musical. But gosh, it took an awful lot of time to find that very simple phrase.
Mm-hmm.
and just, you know, the way we were pitching it. And I think every game has these problems, but a lot of other games have touch points that they can draw from. When you're kind of pushing into new areas, it's harder to find the right way to communicate. And even now, where it's very difficult to communicate what Chorus is, and that's why we've, you know, put a lot of emphasis on sort of videos and stuff like that, and we're just working on right now a proof of concept, like a playable proof of concept that we are going to release like 2 to 3 days before the end of the campaign,
mm-hmm.
So that people can actually play through. Like, it's not going to look like what it'll look like in the game, but it shows how the songs work and what they'll feel like. And that'll be the first time I think people really get to see like what it is we're making in a real way. Which is also extremely nerve-wracking.
How does that compare to opening night of a show?
Pretty similarly. Mm-hmm. Like, same feelings of anxiety. I guess, like, getting up on stage, I would much prefer to get out in front of an audience of 5,000 people or 10,000 people than ship this proof of concept. I can control how I come across in front of an audience. I'm very good at that. You can read a room. You can react to the audience. You can see what's going on. But over the internet, you don't have any of those cues. Not in the same way. So I'm just, like, basically we're working on this proof of concept and then we're just going to lob it out into the public sphere and hope that people see what we're trying to do and will see past the fact that it's a proof of concept and not an actual game. And that's really scary. But yeah, like, I would totally prefer to get up on stage in front of like a bajillion people.
Well, how's it been? So you're how far through the campaign at this point?
We just hit 90% this morning, which is very exciting. We have 6 days to go. So, it's looking positive for sure. Mm.
Yeah, and it sounds like the reaction has been from the folks who you're reaching. Again, like, when I heard about this idea, it was one of those things of, like, how have I never realized just how much I needed this?
Yeah. Like, it's a vociferous response. Like, people are loud, and there's a lot of people who are like, holy shit, it's like this game was made for me, to which I generally respond, yes, it was very intentionally made for you. Like, that, you know, we see you, and we recognize that nothing has been made for you like this before, and we want to make it. And that's really exciting. Like, that's the best possible response you could hope for as a game developer.
Yeah, I was going to ask, that, like, how does it feel to have people respond in such a positive way to something that you came up with?
Like, that's awesome. Like, it's super great. Like, the fact that, you know, Dave and Austin and Troy and myself could finagle something into existence that hits or strikes such a nerve with people is really exciting and vindicating. And, you know, hopefully that means we have a broader audience too. But even if we don't, even if it's just like the 4,000 people who will back this campaign. Like, that's pretty amazing that we, you know, managed to find this audience so specifically. That we worked out, we thought there was an audience there, we created something, and then we were right. That's really nice. Even if it's really small, like, that's really special and really rare. And so I'm very proud of that. Like, I hope that we can do those people justice and create something that, you know, that lives up to that ideal or idea. Yeah. Mm.
So if people want to get involved with the campaign and find out more about the game, where should they go?
Go to summerfallstudios.com or fig.co/chorus.
Fantastic. Well, I cannot wait to see what the game is going to be. I'm so excited for this playable demo. Like I said, it's one of those things I'm like, I need it right now.
Yeah. No, we're very excited to put that out. I think it'll be, it's really short. It's like 5 minutes. Mm. So yeah, hopefully people will like it. It's shaping up pretty well. It's going to be a very nerve-wracking week as we like try to put it together. We've got a recording session with Laura Bailey tomorrow.
Oh gosh.
To record the final vocals. At the same time, we'll be announcing the voice actress for Persephone, which is really exciting. Hopefully we can get it done in time. Hopefully people like it. So
awesome. Liam, thank you so much for this amazing project, and also thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thank you so much, Matt.
Thanks again to Liam for joining me. If you liked hearing from him, you might also enjoy my interview with David Gator, Liam's co-founder at Summerfall Studios. My recommendation this week is to check out David's episode of Sewers of Paris from back in 2016. It's episode 57 of The Sewers of Paris, almost exactly 200 episodes ago. David is perhaps best known for his work on the Dragon Age games, which were extremely queer, with storylines involving coming out, family acceptance, and even transgender characters in an epic high fantasy setting. Like a lot of folks in the game industry, David never expected to work in games. He just ran role-playing games for fun while pursuing a career in the hotel industry. He was even offered a role as a writer, but turned it down, thinking there was no future for him there. But then when he was laid off from his hotel job the next day, he decided to give it another look. One of the themes that comes up multiple times in my interview with David is his shock whenever his colleagues and audiences not only accepted queer content, but celebrated it. For so long, he had kept his sexuality secret or crafted a carefully de-gayed persona because he worried that people would react negatively. But as his creative work grew, he found that the opposite was true, that people were excited and eager to know the real David and to experience the storytelling that he could weave once he was no longer hiding behind a role. Thanks again for listening, and thanks to everyone supporting the Sewers of Paris on Patreon. Visit sewersofparis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon to check out the rewards for backers. Thanks also to everyone who's reviewed the Sewers of Paris on your podcast platform of choice. And remember, our next cozy live stream is coming up on November 16th. There's a link at the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Please reach out and let me know what you think of the show on Twitter and Facebook or at sewerspodcast@gmail.com. The theme song for the show is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of incomptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.